Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
After more than a year investigating, 1,000 witnesses, 9 televised blockbuster hearings, the January 6th investigation sums up its case and finishes with one last surprise.
Committee Resolution 1, resolved that the chairman be and is hereby directed to subpoena Donald J. Trump.
Tonight, the unexpected, historic decision to try to compel testimony from the former president.
I don't want people to know we lost, Mark. This is embarrassing. Figure it out. We need to figure it out. I don't want people to know that we lost.
New information about the advanced planning for the violence that day and the fact that the White House knew it.
The source went on to say their plan is to literally kill people. Please, please take this tip seriously and investigate further.
Plus, never before seen footage as congressional leaders fought to regain control.
They said somebody was shot. It's just horrendous, and all at the instigation of the President of the United States.
In what may be the final hearing of the January 6th investigation, it's time for final answers.
Our duty today is to our country and our children and our Constitution. We are obligated to seek answers directly from the man who set this all in motion.
Tonight, one of the members of the investigation, Congressman Jamie Raskin, plus Nicole Wallace, Joy Reid, Lawrence O'Donnell, Alex Wagner, Ari Melber, Stephanie Ruhle, Jen Psaki, all here for our special primetime coverage of the January 6th hearing.
Good evening from MSNBC headquarters. I'm Rachel Maddow, joined here by some of my beloved colleagues, Ari Melber, Joy Reid, Nicole Wallace, Lawrence O'Donnell. We're going to have more of our colleagues joining us tonight over the course of this special two-hour primetime recap of today's hearing from the January 6th investigation. This, of course, has been a historic series of hearings. There is a ton of public interest in what the investigators are turning up about the violent attack on Congress last year to try to keep the last president in power, even though he lost re-election. But despite the intense public interest in what the investigators have to say, we know a 1 p.m. hearing isn't for everyone. Things like work and school and childcare and all sorts of other daytime responsibilities get in the way of most people's ability to sit down and watch these daytime proceedings. That's why we have you covered. We have committed throughout this entire process to bring you a primetime recap of what happened the night following each of these daytime hearings. The broadcast networks did this in 1973 during the Watergate hearings, which also were held during the workday. Broadcast networks in 1973 aired summaries in prime time of what had happened during the day's proceedings. We believe that was a public service at the time. That was a good use of the airwaves, and it was good for the country. We here at MSNBC are following that precedent of our TV news forefathers by not just bringing you reaction and commentary, bouncing off what happened today. What we're trying to bring you with these primetime recaps is, in fact, a faithful summary, a definitive recap of what happened. We want you to have not missed a thing. So let's start. Let's jump in. The biggest news made by the committee today was the legitimately surprising decision to vote to approve a subpoena for the former president himself, a subpoena to former President Trump, potentially a subpoena to former Vice President Mike Pence. Those are things the committee had all but openly mulled over at earlier stages of their investigation. I think just about every observer, certainly every journalistic prognostication about the committee right now, suggested that a subpoena to Trump or a subpoena to Pence, it was probably too late for that. That was probably off the table. They'd come too close to the end of their work to still be seriously considering that dramatic a step. All those prognostications were wrong. Today, during the hearing, the committee voted to subpoena documents and testimony under oath from the former president.
During this committee's first hearing in July of last year, our witnesses were 4 police officers who helped repel the riots of January 6th. We asked them what they hoped to see the committee accomplish over the course of our investigation. Officer Grinnell wanted to know why the rioters were made to believe that the election process was rigged. Officer Fanon asked us to look into the actions and activities that resulted in the day's events. Officer Hodges was concerned about whether anyone in power had a role. Officer Dunn put it simply, get to the bottom of what happened. We've worked for more than a year to get those answers. Thanks to the tireless work of our members and investigators, we have left no doubt, none, that Donald Trump led an effort to upend American democracy that directly resulted in the violence of January 6th. He tried to take away the voice of the American people in choosing their president and replace the will of the voters with his will to remain in power. He is the one person at the center of the story of what happened on January 6th. So we want to hear from him. This is a question about accountability to the American people. He must be accountable. He is required to answer for his actions. He's required to answer to those police officers who put their lives and bodies on the line to defend our democracy. It is our obligation to seek Donald Trump's testimony.
He's required to answer to those officers who put their lives and bodies on the line. It's our obligation to seek his testimony. That is the chairman of the investigation, Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi. Both he and the investigation's second-in-command, Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, referenced ongoing criminal investigations at the Justice Department when they were talking about this new subpoena to former President Trump. In addition to those remarks you just saw there, Chairman Thompson said pointedly, whatever is underway to ensure his accountability under the law, this committee will demand a full accounting to the American people of the events of January 6th. Whatever is underway. As in, we don't know what's underway at the Justice Department, but whatever they're doing, we still want to hear from him. Vice Chair Liz Cheney put it a little more bluntly.
Other witnesses have also gone to enormous lengths to avoid testifying about their dealings with Donald Trump. Steve Bannon has been tried and convicted by a jury of his peers for contempt of Congress. He is scheduled to be sentenced for this crime later this month. Criminal proceedings regarding Peter Navarro continue. And Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's former chief of staff, has refused to testify based upon executive privilege. The committee's litigation with him continues. Mr. Chairman, at some point, the Department of Justice may well unearth the facts that these and other witnesses are currently concealing. But our duty today is to our country and our children and our Constitution. We are obligated to seek answers directly from the man who set this all in motion. So this afternoon, I am offering this resolution that the committee direct the chairman to issue a subpoena for relevant documents and testimony under oath from Donald John Trump in connection with the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol.
She said that at some point, the Department of Justice may unearth the facts these witnesses are currently concealing. But regardless of whether that happens or not, we're subpoenaing Trump. The subpoena to former President Trump was the biggest surprise from the investigators today. And it raises all sorts of important follow-on questions like, will Trump ever actually have to testify? Will he be required to by the court in a way that he cannot shimmy out of? There's interesting precedent for a handful of other presidents having been subpoenaed before by congressional investigations. We'll talk about that a little later on tonight. But also, if the Justice Department does have Trump in its sights for a potential indictment, what is the impact on that if Trump does have to give sworn testimony to this other body that is looking at the same matters? Also, specifically in relation to the subpoena to Trump, we had Vice Chair Liz Cheney pointedly raising the issue today of the number of people close to Trump who've taken the Fifth, who've asserted their Fifth Amendment rights to avoid self-incrimination when they were asked specifically about Trump. And highlighting that, highlighting the number of times and the number of people who've taken the Fifth. We've all seen mob movies, right? That sort of thing just lands with the public in a specific way, in a really damning way. But is there something more to this line of argument from the investigators?
More than 30 witnesses in our investigation have invoked their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. And several of those did so specifically in response to questions about their dealings with Donald Trump directly. This is Roger Stone with Oath Keepers at the Willard Hotel on the morning of January 6th. And here is Mr. Stone testifying before our committee.
Did you speak to President Trump on his private cell phone on either January 5th or January 6th?
Once again, on advice of counsel, I will assert my Fifth Amendment right to respectfully decline to answer your question.
This is General Michael Flynn walking with Oath Keepers on December 12th, 2020. And here is General Flynn's testimony before our committee.
Did you, General Flynn, talk to President Trump at any point on January 6th, 2021?
The Fifth.
Here is John Eastman fraudulently instructing tens of thousands of angry protesters that the vice president could change the election outcome on January 6th. Later on this same day, Dr. Eastman acknowledged in writing that Donald Trump knew what he was attempting was illegal. Here is John Eastman testifying before our committee.
Did President Trump authorize you to discuss publicly your January 4th, 2021 conversation with him?
Fifth.
So is it your position that you can discuss in the media direct conversations you had with the President of the United States, but you will not discuss those same conversations with this committee?
Fifth.
Here is Jeff Clark, who conspired with Donald Trump to corrupt the Department of Justice. President Trump wanted to appoint Jeff Clark as acting attorney general. And as you can see in this call log we obtained from the National Archives, he did so. And here is Mr. Clark testifying before our committee.
Mr. Clark, when did you first talk directly with President Trump?
Fifth.
Mr. Clark, did you discuss with President Trump allegations of fraud in the 2020 election?
Fifth.
Other witnesses have also gone to enormous lengths to avoid testifying about their dealings with Donald Trump.
Liz Cheney then goes on to reference the Justice Department's ongoing investigation. She goes on to introduce the resolution that was voted on by the committee to send Trump this subpoena. But this is another interesting decision, another interesting question raised by the investigators today. Is it directly relevant to them sending this subpoena to Trump that so many Trump people have been pleading the Fifth? Are they showing us these guys pleading the Fifth over and over again just to remind us of that because it looks terrible? Or is there a specific strategic or legal imperative that's driving them to basically tell us, hey, listen, we tried to get this information every other way from everyone around the former president. They're all taking the Fifth. That's why we have no choice but to go to him. Are they telling us that today in this public hearing in explaining the subpoena to Trump just because legally, they're also going to have to make that case in court to a federal judge soon when it comes time to try to enforce the subpoena and compel Trump to testify. The legal battle over the effort to compel Trump's testimony begins basically today. That battle is effectively joined already today with the vote from the committee that they're going to send him a subpoena. We shall see how that works out. The investigators today, at three different points, they also raised the prospect of other kinds of legal trouble for people who have lied to or obstructed their investigation. We'll get to that in a minute. But before we get to that sort of threat from the committee, let's just, I think, make sure that we understand what's important about this big surprise news today that they are going to subpoena the former president. I'm joined now by Ari Melber and Joy Reid, Nicole Wallace, Lawrence O'Donnell. Obviously, I wouldn't have put it on my bingo card if I had to pick surprise action today that it was going to be a subpoena for Trump. I think I, like most people, thought this was sort of too late in the game for them to try it. I thought maybe they'd announce a criminal referral or something else. Instead, they announced the subpoena, and they did so with lots of reference to other legal factors here. What did you make of it, Nicole?
Look, I think the committee has been driven since the beginning by true investigative principles. And the politics are clear. Democracy is now a top three issue for all voters, and especially independents. I mean, it has political ramifications. I'm not saying they live separate from that, but they've been driven by the investigative theory of connecting the dots. It's abundantly clear that they have tied the violence to a premeditated campaign of lies that Trump knew were lies to Trump. I mean, that was the, for me, that was the aha. And I
we
think
got that word premeditated several
over
times.
Over and over again. Yeah. And what they did today was they really wallpapered 10 different, you know, 10 different layers of wallpaper over the pillars of their investigation that he knew he lost. We went right back to the themes of the first public hearing in the most dramatic storytelling from Cassidy Hutchinson, that he knew that he was lying to his supporters and that he knew about the violence. And I think the subpoena is reflective of the dots being connected around those three pillars of their investigation. Lawrence?
You know, the stages are this committee votes on the subpoena. It then will have to go through the House Rules Committee. You'll see an ugly debate in there because there will be Republicans in there. And then it goes to the House floor. The House floor passes it, presumably on a party line vote. And then, only then, do we get to the point where this might be legally contested. Mm-hmm. And it might not, because it's entirely up to Attorney General Merrick Garland, who has a few pressurized decisions to make already. It's up to him to decide, do I prosecute Donald Trump for criminal contempt of Congress? In other words, that's Steve Bannon route. So that's weeks away at minimum, and possibly not something that even gets to Garland at that level until December or so. We don't know. But when you look at the last group that considered this very question, this subpoena, it was considered while Donald Trump was president, and it was the Mueller investigation team. And I went back to Andrew Weissman's book today, where he has an entire chapter on just this, to read about that decision and just how disappointed Andrew Weissman was that they did not go for a subpoena, that Robert Mueller decided not to. And Andrew Weissman's argument, which I believe he will make again at 10 p.m. tonight on my show, his argument was, we must do this at minimum for history and for any future prosecutors who are in this position in relationship to a president of the United States. And this is one of those hearings that from the start has been about the present day, and they've also been about history. And this, I believe, is a, for them, a necessary historical marker for anyone else 50 years from now, 100 years from now, any other committee who's in a position like this with this question, do we issue this subpoena? And so what happens to it after what they voted on today is completely out of their hands. Mm-hmm. But they voted for history today.
It's interesting that in terms of this, the implication, how the Justice Department is implicated in the actions of the committee here. I've been thinking of it in terms of, well, is it possible that Trump testimony could mess up the Justice Department's investigation or complicate it in some way that DOJ might not want? Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. It also puts yet another set of potential charges on the Justice Department while they're thinking about whether they want to bring any sort of indictment against Trump for any of this.
Well, I mean, but I think the other piece is, number one, it is very clear that Donald Trump cannot ever testify before this committee. I mean, that's clear, right? He cannot tell the truth.
I would pay good money to see it.
I would pay good money to see it as well. I would love to be in the front row and watch it, but he cannot do it because we've seen in, you know, the Tim O'Brien case, he cannot tell the truth. He's not capable of it. But the second thing is he is the sole beneficiary of the insurrection, right? And in all of the roads, and I thought that was the big aha for me, is that even months before the election, they established he was thinking about doing this. He is the sole beneficiary of what happened. His testimony could only damn him. And also, it would preview for the Justice Department, if they ever prosecuted him, what his case would be, right? What he would say in response. But I do think that one of the important things about the subpoena in a positive way for the committee is that one of Donald Trump's chief complaints has been nobody's up there defending me. Right. And that's, of course, the Republicans' own fault because they blew up having a committee of the choice of Kevin McCarthy because he decided to pull all of the members. He had a couple people on there that could have been on and done a decent job, but he wanted the members of the insurrection on it as well. But the temptation for Trump, as somebody who wrote a Trump book and had to interview a lot of Trump people, is that his sort of performative temptation is going to be nobody can defend me like me.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's got to be at least a little bit of temptation.
Would you guarantee me 8 p.m.
Exactly.
And all the networks and it would be just me? And,
yeah. Come down to Mar-a-Lago. He's already indicated he wants to testify. But, yeah. But I mean, to your point, he wanted to talk to Mueller, too. And Rudy Giuliani, I think, said on TV, I'll lay my body down.
This isn't
about what he wants. They right. won't let him. Well, to your point, they won't let him.
And there's a history here. He talks a big game, but he was subpoenaed in the New York case by the attorney general. Yep. And from the subpoena to him complying was 8 months. And then he pled the fifth. It is a bombshell that 30 people around Trump, we learned for the first time today, we didn't know the full number, pled the Fifth Amendment. And so if, like in that case, he ultimately complies, then he could plead the fifth. But then you have the nation seeing him being asked, did you plan it as a coup? Oh, I plead the fifth because of my criminal exposure. Did you intend to cause violence on the sixth? I plead the fifth. Did you intend to have Mike Pence violently attacked or assassinated? I plead the fifth. I don't care what you think of America's ability to process news and facts. That would be a huge deal. And if it's not in criminal court, it can still adversely affect him. He has the right to plead it. But voters have the right to factor in. Do you want to give control of the military back to someone who says, I can't answer that question about a military coup because I might have done it?
Yeah.
Wow. Our primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing continues right after this very short break. There were three separate instances today when investigators suggested there may be legal trouble ahead for people caught up in this investigation beyond the subpoena that we were just talking about. That's all next. Stay with us.
The violence and lawlessness of January 6th was unjustifiable. But our nation cannot only punish the foot soldiers who stormed our Capitol. Those who planned to overturn our election and brought us to the point of violence must also be accountable. Our committee now has sufficient information to answer many of the critical questions posed by Congress at the outset. We have sufficient information to consider criminal referrals for multiple individuals.
We have sufficient information to consider criminal referrals for multiple individuals. Welcome back to our primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing. We know you may not have been able to watch today's daytime hearing live when it happened. We are committed throughout these proceedings to recap what happened on the day side to give you a definitive primetime summary of what the investigators presented to the country today. I do think if you tried to guess in advance what surprise action the investigators might have taken at this hearing, you might reasonably have guessed that they would unveil criminal referrals to the Justice Department, you know, recommending that DOJ consider criminal prosecution of some of the people involved in the attempted coup. It was reported in advance of today's hearing that the investigation had assigned the four lawyers who were on the committee, Liz Cheney, Zoe Lofgren, Adam Schiff, Jamie Raskin, they'd assigned them to become a sort of lawyers subcommittee to look specifically at that question of whether this investigation should make some kind of formal criminal referral to DOJ. We did get Liz Cheney today saying we have sufficient information to consider criminal referrals for multiple individuals. She said at another point today, this committee may ultimately decide to make a series of criminal referrals to the Justice Department. But that was it. We didn't hear anything further about criminal referrals today from the investigators. And that alone is interesting. That said, on three separate occasions today, we got the investigators saying that people lying to the investigation or obstructing the investigation may themselves soon have legal consequences for the people who have done that. And what was particularly unnerving is that they were essentially indicating that the people who have done that may include members of the United States Secret Service.
Much has happened since our last public hearing on July 21st. As the chairman mentioned, we've received new and voluminous documentation from the Secret Service, which we continue to analyze. We've received new witness testimony, including about efforts to obstruct our investigation and conceal key facts.
They'd expressed to me that the president was irate, you know, on the drive up. Mr. Engel did not deny the fact that the president was irate. That, of course, corresponds closely with the testimony you saw this summer from Cassidy Hutchinson, a Metropolitan police officer who was in the motorcade, and from multiple sources. The committee will be recalling witnesses and conducting further investigative depositions based on that material. And I will also note this. The committee is reviewing testimony regarding potential obstruction on this issue, including testimony about advice given not to tell the committee about this specific topic.
The Secret Service and other agencies knew of the prospect of violence well in advance of the president's speech at the Ellipse. Despite this, certain White House and Secret Service witnesses previously testified that they had received no intelligence about violence that could have potentially threatened any of the protectees on January 6th. Evidence strongly suggests that this testimony is not credible, and the committee is reviewing additional material from the Secret Service and other sources. The Secret Service was monitoring this kind of online activity and was sharing and receiving the results of that effort.
This stuff was also a real surprise in today's hearing, at least it was to me. The investigators saying they have significant new evidence of people trying to obstruct the investigation. Obstructing a lawful congressional investigation is a crime. In the comments from Congressman Schiff and Congressman Pete Aguilar, even more intriguingly, we saw them basically narrow it down to say it's Trump White House officials and also people in the Secret Service who they believe may have lied to the committee and engaged in some kind of organized effort to prevent the committee from getting access to certain information about what happened on the 6th. That seems like both a big deal and an unnerving prospect that elements in the Secret Service, I mean, they're not being overtly accused here, but the prospect is being raised here by the investigators that elements in the Secret Service committed crimes to try to derail this investigation. I'm joined once again by Ari Melber, Joy Reid, Nicole Wallace, Lawrence O'Donnell. Nicole, you talked to Pete Aguilar about this today in your show.
Yeah, I mean, I think because point you're making, it's the Secret Service. You don't want to get this wrong. I said, do you think the Secret Service lied to you? She said, well, they weren't truthful. I said, you're going to refer them for lying to Congress? It's a tool in Trump's toolkit. Roger Stone deployed it at a time. Michael Cohen deployed it before he saw the light, if you will. And they left that very much open. I think their strategy is to, I mean, this is about Ornato and Engel. They think they were lied to. There's also a question that they put together with the Secret Service timeline. They abort the movement of Trump to the Capitol at 1:55, but the committee at least isn't saying publicly whether that was to protect Trump or Pence. I mean, because remember on the 5th, Mark Short has a meeting and warns Pence's Secret Service agent, hey, Pence is in danger tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, he's almost like the Whoopi Goldberg scene in Ghost, right? Like, Pence is in danger. They know the night before. And they don't cancel Trump's movement to the U.S. Capitol till 1:55 p.m. as the insurrection's underway. I think they got a ton of evidence. And remember, Ornato and Engel dropped the Secret Service counsel and retained private counsel.
Oh, right.
After the surprise Cassidy Hutchinson testimony. I also think, and no one will cop to this, but I think that they didn't bet on Cassidy Hutchinson for any other reason other than they found her extremely credible. She has specific things in notes, their quotes that they've been able to verify, and I'm told cross-check against other notes. And they found her testimony about the Secret Service incredibly compelling and credible. And they went out and they spent a lot of the time in these intervening months between the last public hearing and today corroborating it.
Okay, the idea, though, of the Secret Service being involved in trying to derail the investigation and lying to the investigation, not just to cover up that they themselves did something wrong, but trying to cover up that, like, Trump grabbed the wheel of the limo or that Trump grabbed a Secret Service agent by the neck. Them lying about that, not just in a CYA move, but instead to derail the investigation into things like that, it's deeply unnerving.
And the deleted text is just the most stunning evidence manipulation in the history of these kinds of investigations. The mass deletion of texts individually by individuals with their devices in the Secret Service doing that by hand deliberately is just a stunning gap in the evidence base in this case.
When there's absolutely no case to be made that they might have thought it was okay to delete them. I mean, clearly, they're completely aware of the importance of those messages and the fact that there would be an investigation.
They are simply the most important text messages in the history of the Secret Service. That's what they're deleting.
Wiped entirely. All right, we've got more ahead, including the frankly stunning footage of what congressional leaders were doing from inside the secure location to which they had been evacuated on January 6th, plus corroboration of one of the most damaging claims about Trump himself, what he knew about the armed crowd that he was directing against Congress. That's all ahead.
Yeah, why don't you get the president to tell them to leave the Capitol, Mr. Attorney General, in your law enforcement responsibility? A public statement they should all leave. Cannot be just we're waiting for so-and-so. We need them there now, whoever you got.
The International Rescue Committee works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Lebanon, displaced families are experiencing rough winter weather on top of war, hunger, and displacement. All of this has driven up food prices, destroyed infrastructure, and driven millions from their homes. Donations help the IRC provide families with resources like food, shelter, fuel, medicine, blankets, and cash assistance. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Back to our primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing. If we looked a little spooked coming out of the commercial, it's because during the whole commercial break, we're like, can you believe that? Can you believe that? You know who the real bad guy is. We'll never tell what happens here behind closed doors, but trust me, we never really stop working. There was new information presented today, new action taken today by the investigators when they voted to issue a subpoena to compel Trump himself to testify under oath. But the most significant new footage that we got today was a total surprise. Apparently, when the leadership in Congress was rushed to safety out of the Capitol building during the attack, a documentarian was there with them. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has a daughter who is a very accomplished documentary filmmaker. Her name is Alexandra Pelosi. I don't think we had previously known that Alexandra was with her mother and shooting footage while the attack was underway. But now we know that she was. And the footage revealed today for the first time was just stunning. When these hearings are on, I tend to pace around my office and like take notes and shuffle papers and eat and stuff. When this footage came on today, I just stared at the screen slack-jawed until it was done. It really was just stunning.
We're starting to get surrounded. They're taking the North Front scaffolding. Look, unless we get more ammunition, we're not going to be able to hold them.
The door has been breached, and people are gaining access into the Capitol.
We have got to get to finish the proceedings, or else it would have a complete victory.
USA! USA!
Senator Schumer is at a secure location, and they're locked down in the Senate.
There has to be some way we can maintain the sense that people have that there's some security or some confidence that government can function and that we can elect the president of the United States. Did we go back into session?
We did go back into session, but now apparently everybody on the floor is putting on tear gas masks to prepare for a breach. Well, I'm trying to get more information.
They're putting on their
tear gas masks.
I can't.
We need an area for the House members. They're all walking over now through the tunnels.
Bring her out!
Hey,
coming in if you don't bring her out!
I'm going to
call up the effing Secretary of DOD. We have some senators who are still in their hideaways. They need massive personnel now. Can you get the Maryland National Guard to come too?
I have something to say, Mr. Secretary. Well, I'm going to call the mayor of Washington, D.C. right now and see what other outreach she has to other police departments, as Senator Leader Hoyer has mentioned. Governor, this is Nancy. Governor, I don't know if you have been approached about the Virginia National Guard. Mr. Hoyer was speaking to Governor Hogan, but I still think you probably need the okay of the federal government in order to come into another jurisdiction. Thank you.
Oh
my gosh. They're just breaking windows. They're doing all kinds of, it's really that somebody, they said somebody was shot. It's just horrendous, and all at the instigation of the President of the United States. Okay, thank you, Governor. I appreciate what you're doing, and if you don't mind, I'd like to stay in touch. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Virginia Guard has been called in.
You know, I'm just talking to Governor Northam, and what he said is they sent 200 of state police and a unit of the National Guard.
They're breaking windows and going in, obviously ransacking our offices and all the rest of that. That's nothing. The concern we have about personal harm,
safety.
Personal safety is just transcends everything, but the fact is on any given day they're breaking the law in many different ways, and quite frankly much of it at the instigation of the President of the United States. And now if he could at least somebody,
yeah, why don't you get the President to tell them to leave the Capitol, Mr. Attorney General, in your law enforcement responsibility, a public statement they should all leave. Cannot be just we're waiting for so-and-so. We need them there now, whoever you got.
You have, okay? You also have troops. This is Steny Hoyer. Troops.
Okay, so we have a
Fort
little bit
McNair,
of time to make that decision.
Andrews Air Force Base.
All right.
Other military bases.
Thank you.
We
Thanks,
need
Paul.
Active
Bye.
Duty National Guard.
How soon in the future can you have the place evacuated, pulled, you know, cleaned out?
I don't want to speak for the leadership that's going to be responsible for executing the operation. So I'm not going to say that because they are on the ground and they're the
experts. Well, just pretend for a moment it was the Pentagon or the White House or some other entity that was under siege. And let me say, you can logistically get people there as you make the plan. Trying to figure out how we can get this job done today. We talked to Mitch about it earlier. He's not in the room right now, but he was with us earlier and said, you know, we want to expedite this, and hopefully they could confine it to just one complaint, Arizona, and then we could vote, and that would be, you know, then just move forward with the rest of the state. The overriding wish is to do it at the Capitol. What we are being told very directly is it's going to take days for the Capitol to be okay again. We've gotten a very bad report about the condition of the House floor with defecation and all that kind of thing as well. I don't think that's hard to clean up, but I do think it is more from a security standpoint of making sure that everybody is out of the building, and how long will that take?
I just got off with the Vice President.
I got off with the Vice President-elect.
Okay, but what we left the conversation with, because he said he had the impression from Mitch that Mitch wants to get everybody back to do it there.
Yes.
I said, well, we're getting a counterpoint that is, it could take time to clean up the poo-poo that they're making all over them, literally and figuratively in the Capitol, and that it may take days to get back.
Yes, I'm at the Capitol building. I'm literally standing with
the chief of police of the U.S. Capitol Police. He just informed me what you will hear through official channels, Paul Irving, your sergeant-at-arms, will inform you that their best information is that they believe that the House and the Senate will be able to reconvene in roughly an hour.
Good news.
Sergeant-at-arms, be in touch about the process for...
And then, in fact, the members were able to return to the Capitol. That call between the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and Vice President Pence, him giving her the news that Congress could reconvene, the transfer of power would be allowed to go forward. Just stunning that we have that moment on film.
I think I watched it the way you did. I was walking around my room doing similarly, and I plopped down on that couch in my hotel room, and you couldn't stop watching it. It's extraordinary, even watching it the second time, to watch the legislative branch, the leadership of the legislative branch, mount a defense of itself against a physical attack from the leader of the executive branch. Because that's literally what it was. It was a war on the executive branch, and including the president of the Senate, the vice president of the United States. And they had to then mount a full court defense of their physical safety and their ability to continue the constitutional process of certifying the election.
Including marshaling nearby states to send troops to defend them because there were no federal resources that were being made available to
them. Something that the president of the United States, in a circumstance where a foreign power had done this to us, we were attacked by some foreign enemy, this would be the president's function.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Speaker Pelosi who had to assume the president's function. It was Vice President Pence who had to assume parts of it. You're watching the legislative branch, the order of succession sort of happen in real time. It was stunning to watch.
Yeah, I think watching, I mean, to use a term that we avoid in court, it was really angering. Right? It was emotional. It was upsetting. If you care about the country and you look at this and you say it's under siege because the outgoing president would prefer violence and a coup, however clumsy and however slowly and sloppily it emerged with the people like Rudy Giuliani. He was the initial face of this illegal effort to overthrow the election. But after the initial face, you get the Proud Boys who have now, again, I don't know how much we've mentioned this tonight, confessed to seditious conspiracy. Members of the Oath Keepers confessed to seditious conspiracy. If you want to know what happened that day, look to their confessions. They've admitted the guilt of those felonies, and their compatriots are being charged with their words and guilty pleas. And so that footage is angering because you see, for a few hours or more, the United States government and the peaceful transfer of power was stopped by violence.
It was,
and the president, the outgoing president, supported that.
Yes. All right, our primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing is going to continue in just a moment. The corroboration of one of the worst and most serious claims about Trump's behavior on the day of the attack, that he knew the crowd was armed and that he wanted the armed crowd to go confront Congress physically. Corroboration of that mind-bending allegation against the president. That and more. All ahead. Stay with us.
Committee Resolution 1 resolved. That the chairman be and is hereby directed to subpoena Donald J. Trump for documents and testimony in connection with the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol.
Okay. When the clerk for the January 6th investigation read out the resolution calling for a subpoena for former President Trump, is it possible that your eye fell on the guy who was sitting behind him? Look on the right side of your screen, and we'll just play it again. As the clerk announces the name Donald J. Trump, you can see this gentleman mouth the words, "Oh, wow." That man's name is Ken Sicknick. The reason that name is familiar to you is because Ken Sicknick is the brother of U.S. Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick, who collapsed the night of January 6th after fighting off rioters at the Capitol for hours. He died the next day. After we saw Mr. Sicknick react that way to the subpoena being voiced and voted on in the room, we reached out to Ken Sicknick today to ask what was going through his mind in that moment. He told us that he was surprised in that moment. He was pleased. He also said he expects nothing will ultimately come of it. In his words, he told us, quote, "I'm not holding my breath." He said he believes that after all these public hearings, though, there is no way that anybody can deny Trump is responsible. And that is why we got from him today, "Oh, wow," in that moment.
Our special primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing continues in just a moment. Committee member Jamie Raskin is going to join us live here next. Stay with us. Welcome back to our primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing. I'm Rachel Maddow. I'm joined here once again by beloved colleagues Ari Melber, Joy Reid, Nicole Wallace, and, of course, the person whose hour of normal television we are all borrowing for tonight, the great Alex Wagner.
Abnormal times.
Good to have you here, A.B. Normal. We've got a ton to talk about in terms of new information from the committee today. Let's get right into it. Let's, in fact, start this hour with the guns.
On the morning of the 6th, the Secret Service was at the Ellipse, screening the members of the crowd as they entered the rally site. And they noticed something significant about the crowd. Tens of thousands of people were outside the rally site, but did not want to go through the magnetometers, the metal detectors that were used to screen for dangerous weapons. Since our last hearings, the Select Committee has received greater cooperation from the Secret Service. In this report, received on December 26th, a Secret Service field office relayed a tip that had been received by the FBI. According to the source of the tip, the Proud Boys plan to march armed into D.C. They think that they will have a large enough group to march into D.C. armed, the source reported, and will outnumber the police so they can't be stopped. The source went on to say, their plan is to literally kill people. Please, please take this tip seriously and investigate further. The Secret Service could also see that many rallygoers were assembled outside the security perimeter. One agent emailed, possibly because they have stuff that couldn't come through, would probably be an issue with this crowd. Just a thought. By 9:30 that morning, agents reported more than 25,000 people outside the rally site. The documents we obtained from the Secret Service make clear that the crowd outside the magnetometers was armed and the agents knew it.
The Secret Service reported that thousands in the crowd near the Washington Monument would not enter the rally area because magnetometers used in screening attendees would detect any prohibited items they carried. Mr. Trump knew this. His Secret Service had told him about it that morning. Even in spite of these warnings, Cassidy Hutchinson overheard the president say this shortly before he took stage.
He wanted it full, and he was angry that we weren't letting people through the mags with weapons, what the Secret Service deemed as weapons and our weapons. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
And when he went on stage, President Trump himself asked law enforcement to let his supporters in the rally site.
And I'd love to have if those tens of thousands of people would be allowed. The military, the Secret Service, and we want to thank you, and the police, law enforcement, great, you're doing a great job. But I'd love it if they could be allowed to come up here with us. Is that possible? Can you just let them come up, please?
In a hearing this summer, with testimony from Trump White House official Cassidy Hutchinson, we first heard this mind-bending allegation that the president was aware people were staying outside the metal detectors, outside the rally site itself, because they didn't want to go through the metal detectors because they didn't want to have to give up their weapons. He knew that and wanted them to be allowed in with their weapons. And then he wanted them to march with everyone else down to Congress with their weapons. Now we've got corroborating evidence from the Secret Service that they did know the mob had weapons. They did know that's why the mob was staying outside the metal detectors. They did tell Trump that before he publicly called for that part of the crowd to be let in. Whether we're still able to be shocked by hearing that kind of thing about Trump, the events that unfolded that day really did shock the people who worked with the president.
Between 2:30 and 2:35, within 10 minutes of President Trump's tweet,
Thousands of rioters overran the line that the Metropolitan Police Force's Civil Disturbance Unit was holding on the west side of the Capitol. This was the first time in the history of the Metropolitan Police Department that a security line like that had ever been broken. President Trump's conduct that day was so shameful and so outrageous that it prompted numerous members of the White House staff and other Trump appointees to resign.
Joining us now is Congressman Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland. He's a member of the January 6th investigation. Sir, thank you so much for being here tonight. I know today was a big day.
Thank you very much, Rachel. It's great to be with you and Alex and Ari and Joy and who I can't see you guys, but I know there's a big group.
Nicole's here, too. A cast of thousands. When you highlighted today those resignations, I thought in that moment that that was arguably the first accountability for Trump. The White House resignations that happened immediately on the occasion of January 6th from people who are close enough to him to see his behavior. Then today we got the latest accountability. You and the committee voting unanimously to send him a subpoena for documents and sworn testimony related to these events. Is there a sort of number line of accountability here that you have in mind in terms of thinking what he has to answer for and how he ought to answer for it? What are you trying to uncover that we don't already know by issuing him this subpoena?
Well, we've talked to more than 1,000 Americans about this. We've seen vast cooperation from people in the Trump administration, people in the Trump cabinet, people in the Trump family even have come forward, people all up and down the government, people in the streets, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, you name it. People have come forward to participate to try to establish some kind of accountability and reckoning for this nightmare that took place against our country. One would think that a former president of the United States would step forward in order to volunteer his participation. I mean, if somebody accused you, Rachel, of trying to overthrow the government or topple an election, I think you would probably be the first person to say, no, I want to come and testify about that and clear up the record. Or alternatively, if you did it and you're proud of it, well, then come forward and testify about, you know, why you think you are the new Mussolini leading a right-wing movement to overturn our government, but have something to say. You're certainly willing to go out and talk to the crowds that, you know, show up for your rallies. Why won't you talk to the United States Congress when you have a legal obligation to do so? And I would think a patriotic duty to meet as well.
We spoke today with the brother of Officer Brian Sicknick, one of the officers who gave his life defending the Capitol. And his brother told us today that he was surprised and pleased by the vote of the committee to get Trump to testify, to try to compel his testimony with this subpoena. He also told us he doesn't expect that Trump ever will have to testify. He told us, I'm not holding my breath. He's glad that you're trying, but he doesn't expect it will ever come to fruition. What would you say to Officer Sicknick's brother and to other Americans who are wondering what this means in practical terms, if this means that Trump ever will be sworn in and compelled to talk?
Well, first, I would thank Brian and I would thank his mom, who was there today. Mrs. Sicknick was there. And I know there were other members of the family and friends as well. And I want to thank so many of the families of officers who suffered through this, who've hung tough with us. And it means a lot to the members of the committee and to our staff. You know, but I would say this, what kind of snowflake is Donald Trump that he's willing to send hundreds and hundreds of other people to go and do his battle? And to attack police officers with Trump flags and Confederate battle flags and turn American flags into weapons. And he's very happy to do that. And he won't even come and explain himself why he thought he had a right to do that or why he thought that was the right thing to do. What is he afraid of? One thing he might be afraid of course, is that under the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, the Supreme Court has determined that in a criminal trial, the prosecutors cannot comment on someone's failure to testify, much less draw an adverse inference from it. You can't even mention it, and that's grounds for mistrial. But in a civil proceeding, the Supreme Court has found unanimously, and this is Justice Scalia's big commitment. He was the one always writing these decisions. He said, if you don't show up for a civil proceeding, it's perfectly fine for that not only to be mentioned and talked about, but used against you and for to be the basis for drawing an adverse inference. So if Donald Trump wants the entire country to draw the most negative adverse inferences from his not showing up, well, he's free to do that. But at that point, also the committee can say if there are any remaining gaps or conflicts or ambiguities in the testimony, we're going to resolve it against him because, as Scalia would say, he has every incentive and motivation to show up. And if he doesn't do so, he's basically confessing. And you can say that in the civil context, whereas you could never say it in the criminal context.
In terms of the mechanics of how the subpoena would be enforced, can you just tell us the next steps? We saw the committee vote live on TV today. Can the committee do this on its own? Does it now go to the full House? How does this work out, and at what point does it eventually end up in court?
Well, the committee can act. It will go through the House of Representatives, and then we have the right to issue the subpoena, as we've done for lots of other people like Scavino and Navarro and Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, of course, has been criminally convicted of contempt of Congress for just blowing off the subpoena. So I don't recommend that to the former president or to the moms and dads of the country. If your kid gets a subpoena, that is something that you can't just hide under the couch, you know. That's something you got to respond to. We have every reason to believe that he will come forward the way that the vast majority of patriotic Americans have come forward. If he doesn't, well, then obviously that creates a different set of problems. And we don't have a lot of time to act on it. But there are, you know, criminal ways of enforcing subpoenas. There are civil ways of enforcing subpoenas. And then also we have the inherent powers of Congress to enforce a subpoena. The Supreme Court has ruled repeatedly throughout our history that Congress has the authority to enforce its own subpoenas as if we are a court ourselves.
Congressman, it's Alex Wagner. Thanks for your time tonight. Given the snowflakey recalcitrance of former President Trump, one wonders whether Vice President Pence is on your list of people to speak with in short order, just because he seems to be more inclined to embrace the institution of democracy and might be a more cooperative witness. And on that note, I'd ask you, given your previous concerns about Vice President Pence and the choices made by his security detail on January 6th, do you at this point have reason to believe that Secret Service agents were trying to remove the vice president from the Capitol grounds for reasons other than his security?
Well, you ask some trenchant questions there. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to give you all the answers to them. Let's just say if there is someone who has not yet been subpoenaed by the committee, that doesn't mean we won't subpoena them. Obviously, the clock is ticking very much on this Congress and on this committee, so decisions have to be made in short order. And I'll just say a lot of what I've learned about the Secret Service, or at least the particular group within it, over the course of this process has definitely raised my eyebrows and my concern. And that's something that could be part of our report. I don't know. And it could be part of, future oversight activity by Congress.
Okay, can I follow up on that? I know that Tony Ornato is a person of great interest here. And we know that Tony Ornato was in contact on January 6th with Keith Kellogg, who is the head of Vice President Pence's national security detail. Keith Kellogg was the one that pushed back on Tony Ornato, who wanted to have Vice President Pence removed from the Capitol. Do you think Tony Ornato may have been doing the bidding of the president when he was requesting for the vice president to be removed?
I don't have enough information to opine about that important question that you just posed. I'll just say I think I've said this before, that the six most chilling words that have surfaced in this investigation, to my mind, were, "I'm not getting in that car." And they might be six of the most chilling words ever to appear in a congressional investigation. I believe this is not a verbatim quote, but I believe that the vice president said something to the effect of, "Well, you're not the one driving the car." So, look, I think that was a very dicey moment for American democracy. On that day, and I speak only to that day alone, Vice President Pence was a constitutional patriot simply by doing his job and by refusing to back down. There are other indicators that, obviously the whole point of the plot was to get Pence to buckle under to Donald Trump on January 6th and to step outside of his constitutional role and to proclaim and announce new unilateral extra constitutional powers just to vaporize electoral college votes from Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. They wanted to either just declare victory on the floor for Trump or kick the whole thing over in the House of Representatives for a so-called contingent election under the 12th Amendment, where we'd be voting not on the basis of one member, one vote, but one state, one vote. They had 27 states. We have 22. Pennsylvania's tied 9-9. So they had a 27-22 win, although they might have lost. I suspect they would have lost the at-large representative from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, but they still would have had 26 votes. So that was the plan, to get Pence to step outside his constitutional role. But there are some suggestions that they also were happy with a backup plan of just removing Pence from the action and then somehow proceeding to declare Trump the victor or kick it into the House for a contingent election. And at that point, of course, we think that, or at least I believe, that Donald Trump would have followed the advice of his disgraced former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who was urging him to invoke the Insurrection Act, as Stuart Rhodes had been calling on him to do, and to declare martial law and then bring in the National Guard to put down the insurrectionary violence he had unleashed against us, but blame the whole thing on Antifa. And that's my best read of where they were going on that day.
Congressman Raskin, Ari Melber here. In this possibly final hearing, we heard a lot about criminal intent on behalf of Donald Trump based on the evidence you gathered. That's not a legislative concept. It's not a leadership concept, much as I know. It's a part of criminal law. It's one of the key elements you need to prove a crime. Are we to take it that the committee today was trying in public to show that Donald Trump had the requisite criminal intent and committed a crime in trying to overthrow the election? Or is that, in your view, overstating it?
Well, that's a great question. But I would start first with the idea of insurrection, which is condemned in a half dozen places in the Constitution. Our Constitution is designed to stop insurrections, and certainly the Civil War proved that as well. There is a little bit of a myth afoot on the right today that the Second Amendment somehow gives people a right to engage in insurrection, which is an utter falsehood and now part of the big lie. But if you start with insurrection, a constitutional insurrection, which can be put down and suppressed by Congress under Article I, is made up of lots of criminal acts. And those criminal acts, more than 950 of them now, have been charged by the Department of Justice for people who conspire to interfere with a federal proceeding, which is what the peaceful transfer of power is on January 6th, or people who engaged in seditious conspiracy, which means conspiracy to put down the government or overthrow the government or interfere with the rule of law. Well, all of those legal violations are building blocks to the larger constitutional offense of insurrection. And so, yes, I think that we wanted to demonstrate the criminal intent in the building blocks of all of these assorted crimes to show that what they add up to is insurrection against the government. And, you know, sometimes they'll cite the Declaration of Independence, which is right. People have a natural law right to overthrow a tyrannical government. But we didn't cite the British Constitution or the Magna Carta. We cited at that point natural right. If you want to wage war against the American government, government in our Constitution. You're doing it on your own time, and you cannot cite the Second Amendment or any other part of our Constitution for somehow a constitutional right to do it. You've set yourself at war against American democracy.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, sir, it is always a pleasure to talk with you basically on any subject. But on this, there isn't anybody better in the country to explain these things with your constitutional law background and your clarity. Thank you. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Rachel, et al.
I will say with the answer that he gave you, Alex, in terms of thinking about how he thinks it was that was going in terms of what they were trying to do with removing Pence and why and what they would then do and how they, the two different paths they would then have to, I mean, that was.
The plan was, it was choose your own adventure. Either way, it was going to end in Trump being, getting another 4 years, I suppose, both of their plans. And also very much leaving the door open to the committee calling, Vice President Pence to testify.
If Vice President Pence believed that they were going to put him in that car and drive him away from the Capitol as part of the plot, so as to advance the overthrowing of the government and the installation of somebody by force rather than by law, if he believed that, and that's why he said, I'm not getting in that car.
By the way, Jamie Raskin has been saying, I'm not getting in the car.
Yeah.
Vice President Pence said to the head of security detail, he says this over and over again, the six most chilling words of this whole thing. And we have had chills.
Yeah. And they're only chilling if they have that implication.
Exactly.
Wow. Our special primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing will continue in just a moment with a look at the consequences for American justice if there isn't accountability here, and much more still to come. Stay with us.
He knew he had lost the election, but he made the deliberate choice to ignore the courts, to ignore the Justice Department, to ignore his campaign leadership, to ignore senior advisors, and to pursue a completely unlawful effort to overturn the election. His intent was plain: ignore the rule of law and stay in power.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Please consider today who had a hand in defeating President Trump's efforts to overturn the election. Vice President Pence, Bill Barr, Jeff Rosen, and others at the Department of Justice, state Republican officials, White House staff who blocked proposals to mobilize the military to seize voting machines and run new elections. A key lesson of this investigation is this: our institutions only hold when men and women of good faith make them hold, regardless of the political cost. We have no guarantee that these men and women will be in place next time. Any future president inclined to attempt what Donald Trump did in 2020 has now learned not to install people who could stand in the way. With every effort to excuse or justify the conduct of the former president, we chip away at the foundation of our republic. Indefensible conduct is defended. Inexcusable conduct is excused. Without accountability, it all becomes normal, and it will recur.
It will recur. Welcome back to our primetime recap of today's January 6th hearing. Today, we got that warning from the investigation's vice chair, Liz Cheney, that this kind of attack, this effort to overthrow the government and seize power by force, to dismiss elections and their results, and instead seize power by other means, it will recur if there isn't accountability for those who did it the last time. Except the next time, Trump or somebody like him will know better than to allow anybody into key government jobs who might say no or throw wrenches in the works along the way toward this kind of a coup. That wasn't actually new evidence, but it was kind of a key persuasive point from the committee today. And there was just one last thing that, to me, I think was new in terms of new evidence. It did build on some public reporting from Mother Jones magazine, but added to it new information about former President Trump deciding in advance, way in advance of the election, that he would say that he won the election even when he lost. Watch.
The Select Committee got this pre-prepared statement from the National Archives. As you can see, the draft statement, which was sent on October 31st, declares, "We had an election today, and I won." And the Fitton memo specifically indicates a plan that only the votes counted by the Election Day deadline, and there is no Election Day deadline, would matter. Everyone knew that ballot counting would lawfully continue past Election Day. Claiming that the counting on election night must stop before millions of votes were counted was, as we now know, a key part of President Trump's premeditated plan. On Election Day, just after 5 p.m., Mr. Fitton indicated he'd spoken with the president about the statement. Sending along again, just talked to him about the draft below. Again, this plan to keep to declare victory was in place before any of the results had been determined. In the course of our investigation, we also interviewed Brad Parscale, President Trump's former campaign manager. He told us he understood that President Trump planned as early as July that he would say he won the election even if he lost. And just a few days before the election, Steve Bannon, a former Trump chief White House strategist and outside advisor to President Trump, spoke to a group of his associates from China and said this.
And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. But that doesn't mean he's the winner. He's just going to say he's the winner. The Democrats, more of our people vote early that count. Theirs voted mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to declare himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm. if Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it. I'm directing the Attorney General to shut down all ballot places in all 50 states. It's going to be no. He's not going out easy. If Biden's winning, Trump is going to do some crazy.
As you know, Mr. Bannon refused to testify in our investigation. He's been convicted of criminal contempt of Congress, and he's awaiting sentencing. But the evidence indicates that Mr. Bannon had advanced knowledge of Mr. Trump's intent to declare victory falsely on election night.
Mr. Bannon had advanced knowledge of Trump's intent to falsely declare victory on election night. Our colleague Stephanie Ruhle has joined us now because we're going to form some sort of sports team.
Some sort of boys club.
There you go.
I just want to let you all know.
What is the significance? I mean, this is obviously they added new evidence to this today. The Fitton memo adding to that publicly reported leaked audio from Mother Jones had previously reported that. What is the significance of Trump having said in advance, before the election even happened, no matter what happens, I'm going to say I won?
I mean, I think this to me was kind of the kind of overarching big thing that we learned today, right? Because if you think about what was happening in the summer of 2020, all the polls, the Pew polls, all of the polls were showing he was losing. So he understood that his campaign was in trouble. COVID was not in a good place. He did the Bible upside down thing where they tear gassed all the protesters so that he could do that demonstration for his evangelical base. So Trump knew that his campaign was in trouble. And campaigns, they understand they have underlying data, as you know very well. They know where they're at, and they understood it wasn't good. The fact that they were already saying, that Brad Parscale was already saying, that you already had Roger Stone saying, who has a history of this, that he, you know, he had the same plan basically in 2000. Just declare you won. That's the way you do it. So did Eastman. He apparently had the same kind of idea in 2016 had they lost to Hillary Clinton. It's premeditation. Mm-hmm. It means that everything that happened after that was premeditated, that Trump said, I'm just going to declare victory and I'm going to manipulate and use the fact that people don't understand the civics of it. They don't understand that the votes that are counted on Election Day, as Steve Kornacki always explains, are not really all the votes. You've got absentee votes, et cetera. It makes it all look premeditated. The delaying of the Postal Service delivering ballots, it makes it all premeditated. And then when you think the end result, plan B is violence, it makes the conspiracy, to me, it brings the entire conspiracy.
And a very, very basic level, it also just makes clear that they didn't declare that there was fraud in the election because they thought there was fraud in the election.
Right.
They were going to say there was fraud in the election.
No matter what. I also think you can pull the timeline back. He asked Zelensky to dirty up Biden because he knows from the data that Biden can beat him.
That's right.
He knows that the head-to-head against Joe Biden is lethal for him because he cuts right at his base and he's afraid of running against him well before the Democratic primaries. So the idea that he can't win, and then it's, you're exactly right. By the summer, he isn't winning. He's totally, you know, I mean, the COVID response would be the criminal investigation we'd be covering if we weren't covering the insurrection. Right. So he knows he's going to lose, and he starts poking around with his outside advisors about how people are voting in a pandemic. And he takes off after mail-in voting. And he starts telling his own supporters, he did it at a rally in North Carolina, don't vote once, vote twice. He turns DOJ in an unprecedented manner, has DOJ, and of course Bill Barr acquiesces willingly, to investigate allegations of voter fraud before an election. DOJ doesn't do that. It defies all DOJ policy. So the efforts are, he knows Biden can beat him years before the election. He knows he's losing by the summer, and he decides to steal it.
And then you can fast forward the timeline and you can no longer say this is just a series of unfortunate events. You can't possibly say at this point, well, gosh, it was just incompetence that the Secret Service on January 5th and January 6th irretrievably delete messages that Tony Ornato, who was Donald Trump's Secret Serviceman, coincidentally retires just before he's supposed to testify before the committee. And you cannot say that given all that law enforcement knew beforehand, that they clearly knew there was an intent to commit violence. You cannot say, well, it was just an intelligence failure. When you put all of this together, the only thing that you can say is more needs to be investigated, especially with the Secret Service, the agency charged with protecting our most prized asset, the President of the United States.
Can I say one thing? Tom Fitton, the guy that is putting this theory
in emails
for January 6th, is also the same Tom Fitton that tells Trump, hey, those documents at Mar-a-Lago, you don't have to give those back. Let's just talk to Tom Fitton. But to your point, Stephanie, there was some great reporting from Ken Delaney and NBC News today about a bunch of FOIA documents that we got that reveal the depth of support that the president, former president, had within the FBI. Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about the Secret Service. Mm-hmm. A lot of this intel that we're seeing today from the committee is from the FBI. And I just have to call attention to this because I found it staggering. And I think on a day like today, it's particularly relevant. This is a letter from a person familiar with FBI operations ringing the alarm bell to a man named Paul Abate, the associate deputy director in charge of all FBI personnel. And he writes, there's no good way to say it, so I'll just be direct. From my firsthand and secondhand information from conversations since January 6th, there is at best a sizable percentage of the employee population here at the FBI that felt sympathetic to the group that stormed the Capitol. And then goes on, at the end of this, we see, I've seen from news coverage that at least one current federal agent is under investigation for participating in the siege. That would be on the Capitol. And that a current Secret Service agent is under administrative leave as his agency investigates the social media postings he's made supporting the insurrection. Nothing about how the Bureau is comprised is unique from any of those other organizations. That is a direct indictment of not just the FBI, but the Secret Service on a day like today when we're questioning the allegiances.
The Secret Service on December 26, 2020, quote, Their plan is to literally kill people. Please, please take this tip seriously and investigate further. How is it that anyone can say January 6th, golly gee, was a surprise? It wasn't.
Our special primetime recap of the January 6th hearing today continues in just a moment. Former White House press secretary, new MSNBC host Jen Psaki joins us next. Stay with us.
On the morning of the 6th, agents received alerts of online threats that Vice President Pence would be, quote, a dead man walking if he doesn't do the right thing. Another agent reported, quote, I saw several other alerts saying they will storm the Capitol if he doesn't do the right thing. The anger reflected in these postings was obvious, the man at the center of the storm on January 6th, President Trump.
We're joined now by President Biden's former White House press secretary, our new MSNBC colleague, Jen Psaki. Jen, it's great to see you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Great to see you.
I'm going to start off by asking you something, and I don't actually know if you can answer this. I don't know if you're allowed.
I'll do my best.
I think you know, but I don't know if you can say. We've been having a lot of discussion here on set and over the course of this recap about some of the sort of disturbing implications of today's revelations about the Secret Service. If the Secret Service was implicated in some of the ways implied by today's hearing, I mean, I worry about President Biden being protected by this agency. And so I have to ask, were concerns about the Secret Service something that you guys were briefed on during the transition or at the start of the administration? Is this something internally that you guys knew that might have had to be a concern for the new president?
You know, Rachel, the scary part is not to my knowledge, no. We were worried leading up to January 6th that Vice President Pence and the team around President Trump would, you know, play some games and delay the confirmation of the vote, would delay the process. And we were prepared to be up all night. That's what we had meetings about and discussions about leading up to that day. But I was not briefed. I asked around to some of my former White House colleagues and also some of my colleagues I worked with on the transition. I have not found a person at this moment who was briefed on the intelligence threats and what the Secret Service knew in the days in advance of January 6th.
Well, then let's say you're Ron Klain tonight. Let's say you've learned all this, you've heard all this. Does this suddenly make this White House take a second look at the agency that's protecting the president?
Well, as you know, there have been some changes in some of the people who played the most problematic roles that we know of to date, Stephanie, right? But the reason I also think that there's no way today was the last hearing is that there are so many questions about what the Secret Service knew and didn't know, what the FBI knew, who knew what in the White House, and questions. And the committee is still reviewing a lot of this documentation. So there are more questions, I bet, the current White House and my former colleagues may have as more is learned. But there are a lot more threads to pull here, which is why I think there probably has to be at least another hearing.
Hi, Jen. It's Nicole. You may have to be in the political nerds club of ex-White House staffers to have been most
I am such a political nerd. I'm happy to embrace it, Nicole.
I see you. I feel you.
Go ahead.
But to have been most horrified by the fact that someone named Johnny McAtee wrote the orders ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan and Somalia. But to hear the evidence presented and the mash of Milley and others talking about that, I instantly thought of the Mattis resignation over the same kind of move. And I just wonder, also Kinzinger developed all that evidence. It's not clear at this point. It felt a little tangential. We don't know what they were developing for the purposes of the final report. It seems to fall in the vein of Trump absolutely knew he had lost and he was leaving. And these were sort of his Hail Mary things. They also happened to be on Putin's honey-do list for him. But tell me how you watched that part of the testimony.
It felt a little extraneous to me watching it. I mean, yes, it was another sign, which I think is why they were using it, that he knew that he had lost and he had a limited amount of time to take steps as president. But it's also important to remember that in advance of that, back in February of 2020, he had already struck this terrible deal with the Taliban, setting a date for withdrawal from
Afghanistan that was really either setting up the next president or setting up himself for failure, unclear. So it felt like more of an implementation of that. But I think what they were trying to do today was make the point that he was counting his days until he was going to be kicked out of there and knew there were things, if he wanted to get them done, he had to do them done. And yes, to confirm, and you were kind of alluding to this, Nicole, but for anyone who hasn't worked in the White House, the person who writes these type of orders are high-level national security officials from the NSC, just to be clear. I can't believe I have to say that, but it's important to know.
Jen, let me just ask you before we let you go. This is another one that I don't know if you can say, but do you have any sense of how closely the Biden White House and the president himself are following these sorts of things? Obviously, we had the series of hearings over the course of the summer. This appears to be the last hearing, at least for now. As you say, there's a good case to be made that there ought to be more of these hearings before the end of the year. How closely are senior Biden administration officials watching this stuff?
You know, my former colleagues would probably tell you, Rachel, they're not really watching it. They're certainly monitoring it. So they will have people in the building who watch it, watch the coverage, watch the full hearing, provide updates to senior members of the staff and the president. He may ask, he's traveling today in the country, so he may ask aides traveling with him for updates. They are going about the business of governing at this point in time. So I wouldn't expect that they are all sitting around kind of monitoring every moment. They're just getting updates from the people who are assigned to that.
Jen Psaki, former White House press secretary, lucky for us, our new MSNBC colleague. Jen, it's great to have you with us tonight. Thank you
so
much.
Great to be
here. All right. That's news that she's making there that, as far as she knows, as White House press secretary, nobody in the incoming Biden White House was briefed about these security concerns about the people who are most responsible for the president's physical safety. That is,
how scary is that?
Yeah, my stomach just flipped over about six times. Our special primetime recap of the January 6th hearing will continue in just a moment. Stay with us.
The president was fired up about the Supreme Court decision. The president's just raging about the decision and how it's wrong and why didn't we make more calls and, you know, just his typical anger outburst. So he had said something to the effect of, I don't want people to know we lost, Mark. This is embarrassing. Figure it out. We need to figure it out. I don't want people to know that we lost.
I don't want people to know that we lost.
Yes.
This is the president reacting to the Supreme Court not rescuing him and overthrowing the election.
Yeah.
I don't want people to know. I don't want them to know we lost at the Supreme Court. I want to hide the fact that I lost the election.
It's the central animating force 100%. Of all of this. I must not, I cannot, I will not be a loser.
Yeah. Even I will not appear to be a loser.
I know, but I am one.
He also says we should have made more calls.
To whom?
In order to avoid losing the Supreme Court decision.
Right.
There's only a very few calls you can make in that regard.
He knew he was never as rich as he claimed.
Right.
He knew he was never on the cover of all those magazines. His whole game was, I need to hide my truth and present something else. This is the man he is.
Yeah, so, he didn't want to be a loser.
So saying we can't let people know that we lost. Mark, I mean, there's a few that's operating on a few different levels. First of all, losing the Supreme Court, losing the election, but also that implies that he knows that he lost.
Yeah, yes. He knows that he lost. Yeah.
I know, Mark, we lost. We have to prevent people from getting to know that.
And there was a mountain of evidence that some of it was old and they renewed it, but they built three towers today. All the evidence that he knew he lost, all the evidence that he'd been told he had lost and that the crazy conspiracies were wrong, and all the evidence that he knew about the violence.
It also makes me wonder again and re-wonder, what was the motivation for taking all of that material out of the White House? He knew that he lost the election. He knew he wasn't president anymore. Yet he insisted on not just taking, but retaining, and is now fighting to retain,
to continue information
that belongs to the United States and to the president.
Because it has monetary value. It's always the game for him. Why does he need to still be president?
Let me off from this, and I'll give you back these things that you seem to care so much about.
But it seems to be, it's not just ego, right? It's that he needs to be president for a reason. And that being president does give him the leverage from any kind of legal liability ever in his life.
Survival.
It's survival. And so it's not just his ego. He does have an enormous, ridiculous ego. But it seems to be there's a greater need to remain president and not to be known, not just because he would be embarrassed that he'd lost.
It's a shell game.
Yeah, there's something more to that.
There is also, I think, the question to Nicole's point about what they've presented here in state of mind. It seems like they have built a criminal referral with these hearings.
Sure.
We did not see anything explicitly like that today, but it does make you wonder if the criminal referral has to be in public, or whether, in fact, they've built this case and they've delivered.
So they built towers with Trump's name on it.
See what
someone
you did
there.
See what you did
there. She's got a late night mind, this one. More of our special coverage of today's January 6th hearings ahead. Stay with us. Thank you for being with us tonight for this special sorority edition of January 6th hearing recap. Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks, Joy. Thanks, Nicole. Thanks, Alex. We don't know if we will be doing this again because we do not know whether there will be another January 6th daytime hearing. But if there is one, we will all
back
be summoned to this exact location.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.